Well, good evening and welcome to you all. Welcome to this, the third Miliband lecture in the series Culture in the Age of Global Communications. Our speaker this evening is Professor Wang Hui from Tsinghua University. I've been working on this all day, and thank you. And he will speak this evening on problematizing Asia, reflections on the reemergence of the discourse of Asia. The trend to promote regional integration and internal cooperation in Asia has intensified since the 1997 financial crisis and the 9/11 attacks. Professor Wang Hui will reflect on these developments and ask, what are the historical conditions for new Asian discourse to emerge? What is the relationship between the tendency for this discourse to emerge and ideas found in the 19th and 20th centuries? And what are the cultural possibilities? And what cultural possibilities are there for Asia today? Now, our visitor is extraordinarily prolific. In fact, his productivity is quite remarkable. Most of his publications are in Chinese, and so since you may not know them, some of you in this audience, I will just mention four or five which seem to me the most important. Rekindling Frozen Fire, The Paradox of Modernity, published in 2000. The Rise of Modern Chinese Thought, in two volumes, published in 2003. Illusions of Development, published in 2000. And Cultures and Publicity, published in the late 90s, 1998. And that's just the tip of an iceberg. For those of us struggling with our Chinese, he's kindly published recently with Harvard University Press an extraordinarily impressive volume called China's New Order. And William Kirby of Harvard University refers to it on the back as an incisive, brilliant, and always challenging analysis. That means, of course, he doesn't agree with all everything you say, of China's intellectual landscape in the 1990s. We're delighted to welcome you here this evening. We much look forward to your lecture, and it remains for us to warmly welcome you. So thank you for coming.
Thank you. It's my great honor to be here, to be invited to this forum. And speaking English always makes me nervous, anyway. But I try my best to do that. So I wrote the paper. It's originally it's in Chinese. It's quite a long paper, so it's not possible for me to read through the whole paper. So I just select some issues to discuss here. And so this is what I introduced here, the problematizing Asia, some reflections on the reemergence of discourse of Asia recently. The neoliberal notion of globalization and the notion of new empire that reemerged in the war against the terror reciprocate with each other and have unveiled the dominating power concealed behind the challenge, changes in the contemporary world. In order to countervail the pressure of the expansion of neoliberal empire, the European society attempts to protect itself with a kind of form of EU. Everybody knows that it's a big change now, big development now. In a similar background, the category of region again becomes a resource for imagination, evinced, for instance, by how prolific new imaginations regarding the notion of Asia are in contemporary times. After the 9/11 attack, the China suggested itself to join the Asian Treaty for Cooperation and Friendship in the formula of the 1+10, and immediately after that, the Japan suggested the formula of 3+10. That's including Japan and Korea and with Southeast Asian countries. Even earlier, the treaty between China, Russia, and the Central Asia countries has been concluded in Shanghai. That's called the Shanghai Liu Guo, Shanghai Six Countries. So in 2002, I noticed that a Japanese news agency published an article saying that if the unification of Asia accelerates, the sense of distance between Japan and China will tend to disappear naturally in the process of regional unification. Eventually, based on a first regional negotiation occasion that excludes the United States, a conference of Asian and the leaders of Japan, China, and the Korea, then Japan and China may achieve an Asian version of the reconciliation between France and Germany. So even last 2 weeks, I read the newspaper that some former Japanese diplomats and our Indian geopolitical scientists suggested that China, Japan, and India to be the axis of the Asian version of NATO, even. So, however, Asia differs drastically from Europe in political system, economic structure, and cultural tradition. Internally, it is also a highly diversified region. When we discuss the question of Asia, we cannot avoid the following problems. The first, since 19th century, different forms of Asianism have always been closely related with different forms of nationalism. Even in the context of resisting new liberal globalization, Asian imagination is often part of the imagination of nation state. In that case, what role does the national state play in the concept of Asia? Second, in a wave of modern nationalism, the concept of Asia in Eastern Asian countries contains two opposing aspects, that is to say, the Japanese colonialist concept of Asia centered on the notion of great Asian sphere of common prosperity, and the socialist concept of Asia centered on Asian national liberation movement and a socialist movement. In a global context of the collapse of socialist movement and the reconstruction of Asian imaginations, how should we regard and handle the socialist legacy in Asia? I raised this question due to the fact that the contemporary discussion on Asia, almost nobody touches upon the legacy of socialist, the idea of Asia there. So always go back to another, the knowledge that's a colonial knowledge of Asia. So the analysis that follows is a response to the ongoing discussion of Asia intellectuals on the question of Asia. I hope by exploring the interaction between the category of Asia and the modern history, some analytical orientations in regard to the question of Asia can be found, so that new imaginations of Asia may benefit from the answers to the above mentioned historical questions. So my discussion focused on the fields related to the China, or Japan, Korea, because besides the limitation of my own knowledge, I also hope to develop historical understanding of China and its problems from the perspective of Asia. My discussion will be divided into three parts. The first question is the derivativeness of the idea of Asia. The idea of Asia is not an Asian, but a European notion, historically speaking. European enlightenment and colonialism provided preconditions for the pursuit of knowledge in the 18th century, 18th and the 19th centuries. The branches of learning, historical linguistics, modern geography, philosophy of rights, theories of state and the race, historiography, and political economy developed quickly along with the natural sciences, and together they drew a new world map. The ideas of Europe and Asia were integrated into the notion of world history under such a new knowledge conditions. Since the European nation state and the expansion of the capitalist market system were considered as the advanced stage and the end or telos of world history, Asia and its characteristics were consequently designated to a low stage of history. In this context, the Asian was only a geographical, not only a geographical category, but also a form of civilization. Asia is a political form in opposition to European state, a social form in opposition to European capitalism, and a transitional stage between an unhistorical stage and a historical stage. This derivative discourse on Asia provided a framework for European intellectuals, Asian revolutionaries, and the reformists, and the historians to represent world history and Asian societies, to establish the revolution and the reform policies, and to describe the past and the future of Asia. In most of the 19th century and the 20th century, the idea of Asia was contained in a universal discourse of European modernity that provided a similar narrative framework for both colonialists and the revolutionaries, who produced two opposing blueprints of history. This narrative framework has three key concepts. That's the empire, nation state, and the capitalist or the market economy. It is worth noting that to compare Europe and Asia with a focus on their state structure is an important tradition in European political thinking that appeared during the historical conflicts of European countries with the Ottoman Empire. According to Perry Anderson, the contrast between Western European feudal states and Ottoman Empire was eventually transformed into the contrast between European nation states and Asian empires. As a result, when we read the accounts on Asian empires in Montesquieu's Spirit of Laws, it is difficult for us to recognize that despotism, which is regarded as the characteristic of Asian countries, was in fact derived from the European generalization of Ottoman Empire, Ottoman culture. It was in the Western European context, a transition period from feudal states to nation states, that the notion of despotism became so closely associated with the notion of empire, whence the concept of state as opposed to empire acquired its superiority in value and in history. So this kind of the discourse of Asia in European political thinking deeply influenced political thinking in Asia from late 19th century to 20th century. So my second question discussed here is the idea of Asia in two forms of Asian nationalism. In the Asian national liberation movement of 19th century and the 20th centuries, new forms were acquired by the pattern of antithesis between empire and the state that was closely associated with the idea of Asia in Europe political thought. For instance, in the discourses on departure from Asia and joining Europe, in Japan, national autonomy by Russian revolutionaries and pan-Asianism by Chinese revolutionaries, the idea of Asia invariably had an internal connection with ethnically complicated empire and its culture. These notions can be regarded as emblems revealing that the different forms of Asian nationalism, although historically opposed in substance, all constructed visions of national imaginaries within the antithesis between nation-state and empire, variously integrating the appeal to establish nation-state with the appeal to transcend nation-state. The resulting forms were imperialism and internationalism. The idea of Asia represented in the slogan of departure from Asia and joining Europe was raised in a short essay by Fukuzawa Yokichi, which was published in 1885. Departure from Asia reveals a determination to get rid of the China-centered world and its politics and the Confucian ideology. And joining Europe means to establish Japan as a European-style nation-state. We could summarize Fukuzawa's main idea of Asia as this. First, the idea of Asia is a culturally homogeneous concept, which represents the idea of a Confucian Asia. Hence, the idea of here is equal to the idea of China-centered East Asia. Second, the departure from Asia and joining Europe could be interpreted as a departure from Confucianism by transforming Japan into a national state, which should orient toward the freedom, human rights, sovereign state, civilization, and so on. In this sense, the sharp confrontation between empire and the nation state, between the China-centered tributary system and the state-based treaty system, have been used to redefine the relationship between Japan and Asia. So in that sense, Japan's self-consciousness as a nation state was achieved through the slogan from departure from Asia and joining Europe. Fukuzawa argued that it is no difference between the royal court and the people, the ordinary people, in pursuing everything from Occidental civilization, not only departing from the old pattern of Japan, but also reshaping axis in the whole Asia. The key for this is departure from Asia. So, however, in reality, of course, Japan's role in the late 19th century, early 20th century, as a nation state, was not departure from Asia and joining Europe, but rather entering Asia and confronting Europe and America. The notion of Great Asian, East Asian co-prosperity sphere as a colonial slogan promoted in the early 20th century invinces the other side of the practice of departure Asia and joining Europe. According to Professor Kuyasu Nobukuri, which this kind of departure, the slogan, was a construction, construction ex post facto for legitimizing the Japanese invasion into Asia. The idea of departure from Asia reproduces the dichotomy of civilized and the barbarian, West and East in Asia, which defined Japan's relation to Asia as Great Britain's relation to Europe and its imperial era. The national liberation movement in Asia created a new Asian imagination, which is a series of echo to the socialist idea of Asia in the Russian Revolution. The key point of this new Asian imagination is to connect the issue of political social reform in Asia and the right of nations to self-determination. However, as same as the theory of departure from Asia in Japan, the theory of the right of nations to self-determination was elaborated on within the dichotomy of nation-state and empire. 27 years after Fukuzawa Yokichi brought out his own departure from Asia, and soon after the Republican Revolution erupted and the provisional government of the Chinese Republic was established, Lenin published a series of articles that democracy and Narodism in China, the Awakening of Asia, that's 1912 and 1913, and the Backward Europe and Advanced Asia. He applauded the whole Chinese Revolution. So several years later, he developed, after that, the theory of imperialism and argued that as capitalism entered the stage of imperialism, the social struggle of the oppressed races all over the world would be integrated into the category of the world proletarian revolution. So that's Lenin and Fukuzawa's opposition opposing views are based on common basic understanding. That is, Asian modernity was the outcome of European modernity, and regardless of Asia's status and fate, the significance of its modernity manifested itself only in its relationship with the advanced Europe. Hence, the advanced position of Asia in Lenin's theory is actually ambiguous. So in Democracy and Narrowism in China, he says, Russia is undoubtedly an Asian country, and what is more, one of the most benighted, medieval, and shamefully backward of Asian countries. Although he was warmly sympathetic to the Chinese Revolution, Lenin's position was Western European, when the issue switched from the Asian Revolution to the changes within the Russian society. So the special position of Asia in the rhetoric of world history decided how the socialists understood the task and the direction of modern revolution in Asia. For example, when Lenin discussed the awakening of Asia, he was not concerned with the issue of socialism, but how the political prerequisites of the capitalist development could be created. That is, how to create the national state system. Lenin plainly pointed out that the inherent connection between the nationalism and the capitalism. He said that the capitalism, having awakened Asia, has called forth national movements everywhere in that continent too. The tendency of these movements is toward the creation of national states in Asia. It is such states that ensure the basic conditions for the development of capitalism. So it was neither revolution nor Asia's particular civilization, not the development of capitalism development of capitalism that demanded a revolution. So Lenin's arguments provides us with an outline to understand the relationship between the modern Chinese nationalism and the idea of Asia. When he visited Kobe in 1924, Sun Zhongshan, this is the first president of the Republic of China, made his very famous speech entitled The Great Asianism. So this essay was cited repeatedly in the reemergence of discourse of Asia now. He generally distinguished two ideas of Asia. One had no independent states and was the origin of the most Asian civilization. The other was about to rejuvenate. The former has inherent connections with the ethnically complex states in Lenin's argument. But what does the starting point of Asia, rejuvenation or rejuvenated Asia? Sun Zhongshan claimed that the starting point was Japan, since it abolished a number of unequal treaties and became the first independent state in Asia. In other words, we can say that this starting point is nation state rather than Japan. Sun Zhongshan applauded the outbreak of the Russia-Japanese War and subsequently the Japanese triumph that war occurred in China at northeast China. He said that triumph. He described that triumph, the Japanese triumph, as the great hope of national independence in Asia is born at that time. He called attention to a subtle notion, all Asian nations. The notion is not only Asia as the origin of the most Asian civilization, but also Asia that contains independent nation states. It is not only East Asia within the Confucian cultural sphere, but also a multicultural Asia. The unity of Asia was based on the independence of sovereign states. He insisted that Asia has its own culture and principles, what he called so-called the culture of the kingly way, as opposed to the culture of the hegemonic way of European nation state. He entitled his speech Great Asianism, partly because he connected the idea of Asia with the notion of the kingly way. Within the category of political culture, Sun Zhongshan talked about the China, Japan, India, Persian, Afghanistan, Arabic, Turkey, Bhutan, and Nepal, and the tributary system of Chinese Empire. Cultural heterogeneity is one of these main characteristics of his idea of Asia, and the category of nation provides the vehicle for the heterogeneity inherent in the idea of Asia. He hoped that actually the multiplicity of dynastic culture could be united with the new relation between the nation states so as to alleviate the imperialist culture colonization and the tendency of high degree cultural homogenization in the nation states. So to him, the Great Asianism or Pan-Asianism is antithetical to the proposal of Great East Asianism in the modern Japan. As a form of multiculturalism, it criticized the notion of East Asia, which was highly homogenized and regarded the Asian states' national self-determination as the path to surpass the colonialist logic. So Sun Zhonghan's idea of Asia has ostensibly racist remarks, but it attempted to transcend the historical limits of racism by introducing a more basic standard to surpass national oppression. For instance, he defined the Russia as European, but regarded the new liberation movement and the new culture after the October Revolution, because at that time, after the October Revolution, Lenin claimed that the Russia decided to abolish the unequal treaties with China and other Asian he concluded in that period. Actually, that's proved not really immediately abolished at all. So that's the two forms of the idea of Asia in the modern nationalism. So the third question of mine is the idea of Asia in the historical studies and contemporary debate. I just selected some cases here. The driving force to construct the organicity, because when we talk about a lot of the debates and the discussions on the idea of Asia, we always try to many conferences in Tokyo, Beijing, Taipei, Hong Kong, and other places. They focus on the internal connections in the region, but obviously everybody knows that the Asian as a region is highly diversified. So how to construct the organicity or self-containment of the East Asia became a topic there. So in that sense, the driving force to construct the organicity or self-containment of the East Asian world has always been the idea of the nationalistic, industrial, and the capitalist, the West, in the 20th century. The notion East Asian civilization sphere was the organic constituent of modern Asian nationalistic knowledge, and the people were seeking behind it not only cultural particularity, but also the inherent and universal dynamic of nationalism. So this is a paradoxical situation. Hence, the effort to search for modernity in Asia deconstructed, on the one hand, the Hegelian framework of world history, but on the other hand, the inherent standards of the Hegelian world order were not abolished, but reconstructed. That nationalism, capitalism, and the theories of state set up a meta-history of the narrative of Eastern Asian history. For example, that's a lot of discussion in not only now it's in the 20s, 30s, and the 40s, especially during the war. The very important school, the historical school in Kyoto, that we called the Kyoto School, the representative of this school are the Nathan Kuna, Miyazaki Shisada, those imperial scholars. But the historical, from the perspective of historiography, they are very outstanding scholars there. So in that sense, they are in parallel to the Japanese invasion to Asia, that they constructed, they produced a huge the knowledge of Asia in order to construct the idea of Asia as an organicity. So then that's a very important thing. And also that organic idea of Asia is parallel to the idea of Europe. That's in the modernity. So they trace back, they argued that, for example, The Asian modernity started from 10th century. That's a Song Dynasty. And because in that period, Song Dynasty has been a kind of the proto-nation state. So this kind of the knowledge almost disappeared after the World War II. However, now in contemporary discussion, because of we focus on the idea of Asia, this kind of the idea of Asia re-emerged, but with different orientations, different meanings. So there was a new tendency in the ongoing discussion, which aims at a criticism of both departing from Asia and at that time, the Japanese particular reason. One of them is, it's a Professor Hamashita Takeshi's discussion of Asia, Asian tributary system, in which he reconstructed in the field of economic history Asian world order that centered on China and was connected through the tributary system and thereon recognized the historical connection with Asia, which differed from the European world system. That is, in modern Asia, during its transitional period, there was no nation state in the Western sense. Its regional history consisted of tributary networks that transcend the nation. Its inner dynamic was stirred up by such a tributary system under the historical restraint of which Japan's departure from Asia and the modernization took place, which were not the goal, but rather means to break free from Japan's status as a tributary state. Therefore, Asia was described as an organic unity with its own inner mechanism for the first time. East Asia, Southeast Asia, South Asia, and West Asia form an orderly region through the tribute or the trade in a tributary network that's centered on the Chinese civilization. The inner logic thereof, the regional relation between center and the periphery, that was the agreement with state and the compatible tribute investiture system was different from European modernity. So Hamashita's account was inspiring to some extent. He discovered the inner theme to connect Asian states and used it as a clue to envision the contemporary world. He also used the perspective of the periphery to expose the continent centralism and the principle of dynastic orthodoxy in official Chinese historiography. This is a forceful criticism of advocates of the particularism who refuse to recognize the historical communications between Japan and Asia. For Chinese scholars who are used to look at China from within, the theory provides them with a perspective to look at China from the periphery. However, the implication of the new narrative should be examined carefully. The first so-called tributary system was in fact the result of the interaction between the subjects and the participate in this subject that participated in this system. The practice of tribute was therefore a historical product and not a self-contained or complete structure. In this sense, the tribute practice was a continuously changing relationship between the multiple power centers. Whenever a new power joined in, the internal power relationship would change. An overly steady framework of center periphery will not be able to reveal how the tribute practice changed continually in history. The continuation the continuous shift of the center-margin relation is one of the most important characteristics that distinguish the modern capitalist world from the conventional empire. Hence, the construct of the center-periphery relationship with China as the center cannot reveal the transformations of power relations within Asia since 19th century. So, for example, when the Europeans arrived at Eastern Asia at the beginning of the 16th century, they tried to connect with the official tribute system so as to promote trade development. But they realized that they increasingly rely on the extensive Chinese overseas trade network, especially since after the beginning of the 19th century, the official tribute system that centered on China was merely a fantasy of the government concerning control that had never been realized because China was confronted with the growing hegemony and the invasion of imperial powers. Therefore, to a large degree, it was not the official tributary system, but private Chinese overseas trade networks that integrated the Eastern Asia regions into an inherently related history system. The second, in the vision of maritime Eastern Asia brought together by the tributary network, historical communications within the Asian continent and their changes were reduced to a subordinate and a marginal state. Therefore, this narrative responded to the economicism logic and the framework of maritime theory in European capitalist narrative. For the same reason, this historical world that has its inner unity centered on East Asia and Southeast Asia and stressed the importance of culture, ocean, and the political structure for the formation of regional relations, especially regional trade relations. But this idea of Asia that emphasizes the unity lacks a thorough analysis of continental communications that's between China and Inner Asia, Western Asia, South Asia, and Russia that dominated the tributary system for a long period and seldom touched the relations between the formation of the maritime trade sphere and the dynamic from within the continent. So the third, the theory of the tributary system was created by opposition with that of European nation states and their treaty system. It overthrew the earlier idea that regarded the nation state as the only driving force for modernity. But the dichotomy of the tributary system and the treaty system is also derived from that of the empire and the state. Just as the tributary system and the treaty system were not two opposing categories in the Chinese history, so could the tributary system be a form of state relations since the European countries established different forms of relations between the states when they were setting up bilateral trade, political, and military relations. So in that sense, if it is an inherent characteristic of the tributary practice that the relationship between the states and the tributary relations overlapped, shall we not observe the Western states or the domestic and the international relations from another perspective, regarded the treaty system not as a structure form, but a result of the historical interactions between the different power and forms. So the movement of the world does not simply operate around the capitalist system that centers on Europe. Its operation is the process in which multiple worlds of history, communication, and the fight within each other permeated into each other and mold each other. When historians located Asia in a global relations, they realized first that the issue of modernity was not an issue of a certain society, but the result of interaction between different regions and civilizations. This idea of Asia, which is neither starting point nor the end, neither self-sufficient subject nor subordinating object, provides an opportunity to reconstruct the world history and the new idea of Asia. So let me summarize my some thoughts here. The accounts of Asia that we have discussed above revealed less the autonomy of Asia than ambiguity and the contradictions in the idea of Asia. This idea is at the same time colonialist and anti-colonialist. colonialist, conservative and a revolutionary, nationalist and an internationalist, originated in Europe and shaping the self-interpretation of Europe, closely related to the issue of national state and overlapping with the vision of empire, a concept of civilization as opposed to that of Europe and a geographical category established in the geopolitical relations. So the keys to transcend or overcome such derivativeness, ambiguity, and inconsistency could be discovered only in the specific historical relations that give rise to them. The first, the idea of Asia was created in close relation to the issue of modernity or the development of the relationship between the nation state and the market. The tension between the nationalism and the supranationalism is closely related to dual reliance of capitalist market on state and cross state relations. Discussions on the early modernity of Asia and Asian capitalism strongly impacted the use of the notion of Asia today, since such discussions often focus on issues such as nation state and capitalism, the diverse historical relations, policies, and the governance, customs, and the cultural structure of Asia societies nested in the narrative of modernity. Values, policies, and the rituals independent of this narrative of modernity were surpassed or marginalized. One goal of my discussion is to examine whether some of them, values, actually the policies, rituals, and the economic the relations, and so on and so forth, can be utilized, revitalized under the new historical circumstances. The second, the dominance of the nation state in Asian imaginations arose from the dichotomy of empire and the nation state created in modern Europe. This dichotomy, however, underestimated the diversity of political and economic relations that were summarized as belonging to the category of empire and underestimated the diversity of internal relations with nation states. Nowadays, national states remain the main driving force of regional communications in Asia. Therefore, regional problems often take the form of the extension of national relations. The question is, as nation state has become a dominant political structure, will the traditional experiences of communication, coexistence, and the policies and the regulations of Asia provide ways and opportunities to overcome the internal and external dilemmas brought about by the nation state system? So the third, the unity of Asia as a category was established as opposed to Europe. It encompasses various heterogeneous culture, religions, and other social elements. Whether we based our judgment on historical traditions or current circumstances, one does not see the possibility or conditions in Asia to create our European Union-style superstate. Any attempt to summarize the characteristics of Asia with one unitary culture will fail. The idea of Asia has never been a self-definition. It is rather the result of the interaction between this region and other regions. The criticism of Eurocentralism does not seek to confirm Asia-centralism, but to eliminate the self-centered exclusivist and expansionist logic of the dominance. In this sense, to discern the internal disorder and the diversity of new empire, and to reject the self-explanatory idea of Europe is not only the premise to reconstruct the idea of Asia and of Europe, but the inevitable road to break through the logic of the new empire. The fourth, the commonality of Asian imaginaries, partly came from the imaginators' common subordinating status in colonialism, the Cold War period, and the global order, and the trends of national self-determination movement, socialist movement, decolonization movement and the democratization movement. We will not be able to understand the modern significance of Asia or the origin of the disunion and the war crisis in Asia if we forget these historical conditions and the moments. So this, because of this, so there was some new development here that's I'm really glad to see that we this kind of the discussion on Asia re-emerged immediately after the 1997 financial, at that period, after the financial crisis. That's the driving forces there. Many, many intellectuals from Eastern Asian countries, as I know, they feel that it's very difficult for a single country to sustain from that dominant orders, so risky orders. So in that sense, a lot of the discussions happened in Korea, South Korea, China, China mainland, and Taiwan, and especially the Japan. Every year, there was a lot of the discussions that. In the first stage, the intellectuals really want to retrieve some historical sources for the new imagination. However, immediately, many intellectuals feel that the risk is also there because these kind of the history. Then, now the new developments in this side is that many in the conference or the organizers of these conferences, they try to not only focus on the East Asia or South Asia, but try to get the people together. It's not only that they invited, for example, the scholars from Europe and America, especially they try to have the dialogue from between like Eastern Asia intellectuals and like India intellectuals, Nepal intellectuals, they together. So several journals established. Then a lot of the analysis, not only focus on the abstract idea of Asia, but also to the historical events which connected our history together. For example, they're talking about the history in 1948, the tragedy in the South Korea, and then something happened in Taiwan the same year, and what happened in Indonesia in the 60s, and then the Cultural Revolution and its influence in the whole region. So in that sense, these kind of the analysis leads us to they provide us some possibilities and the potential that which means that the intellectual discussion on the issue of Asia now relates to the ongoing social movements there. So that's the, I see the new developments. It's, thank you. I stop here. Yes.
Well, thank you very much. And I'm sure there will be questions to follow. I certainly have some. Let's start with the floor. Rick, please, gentleman up there to the right. I think I usually take questions in clusters, but I think it might be easier tonight if we take them just one at a time.
Yeah. Very welcome to LSE, Professor. Yeah. I agree your idea. There might be similarity for China, Asia, and Europe in that nation state. There might be similarity, but China was very, very different, significantly different from any country in the world. So sometimes when we compare something in the past or some international concept, the system, we need to see whether we can do it, because they might be very different for China, civilization like China. Very big country, many people, our civilization are very different. You can find 20%, 30% similarity in when you compare some in international system and nation state, but there may be many different. So when we do some research, there might be something we may have misdirection, and something you need to do some adjustment. But good to have that one. But China very different from Japan and Korea also. So we are very big empire and. No one knows the past exactly 100%. So we only know 10% in history. So when we compare using European concept, there might be something very interesting to come out. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do you want to?
Yeah, okay.
Please.
Yeah, of course. Stand there.
No, please. We sit, okay. Sit down for questions.
Yes, it's every society, especially like China, with such huge long history and its own culture, there are its own very specific or particular characteristics, which it's not easy to define them or to simply compare these systems or the whole things. Especially in the long history, we're talking about China. However, China underwent so long history, and itself underwent the change. So when we're talking about the China, when which period and which dynasty or the which that's very important. A lot of the difference there, too. And here, that's why, to some extent, I agree with that. You have to employ the concept or terms to define that. And one of the issue, actually, I discussed here, it's a tributary system, which is also very ambiguous term, the very ambiguous term. You can see the first time when the people use the tributary system to define the Chinese relation to the outside world. It's from the period of the Fairbanks work on that. At that time, he tried to use the tributary system to define, to argue that because of that tributary system, China always is self-centered and have no ability to communicate it with the outside world. However, it's here like Hamashita Takeshi and many, many other scholars, historians, to study that historical communications to find that there was a very rich legacy in the communication between China and other the outside and different layers. And even when we use the tributary system, however, this term itself should be redefined because, as I argued here, every participant involved in the relations with China, in the names of the tributary system, actually their relations changed a lot. For example, in the Qing Dynasty, the Mongol, Tibet, and some other we thought that the tributary states to China, there it belonged to the tributary system. However, other states, when empires even involved in the communication with China, like Russia, Spain, and other European states, they also we talk about here. It's about the state system. However, at that time, they also defined as a tributary relations too. So, in that sense, how to understand that it's a very complicated issue. So, this is I agree with that. The second one is that. Most of the discussion is not only that I believe that it's not only the concepts of notions we used to explain our history, but also the basic narrative of history. For example, we focus on, as I mentioned, that we focus on the economical relations when we're talking about these kind of the interactions. Actually, we almost forget all the things like a ritual practice and the religious relations and some other part of our daily life. So this is now many historians try to challenge that older model of the historical narrative.
Yeah, please.
My question is in two parts. When I'm looking at, say, an area like Europe, you can almost like feel that there's one sort of central drive within Europe, which I would say the relationship between the religion and Europe, and how we've gone from a very top-heavy kind of society to almost like people are able to define their own religions and define their own beliefs. So that kind of burst of consciousness seems to typify Europe. Now, for the area of Asia, I know it's very diverse, but is there a similar way where you can encapsulate the flavor of Asia in, say, one journey like that? So that's the first part of my question. The second part of my question is that in, say, Europe, someone who captures this the various aspects of Europe, I would say, is a figure like Shakespeare. Now, in Asia, is there a figure that can capture the different aspects of the Asian experience the way that Shakespeare can does for the Western civilization?
It's a really difficult question, because your first question is about the religion, right? It's
no, is there a central concept that you can have on an identity of
everything? Okay, I see. Yeah, right.
Religion, yeah. Asia.
Yes. So that's no such thing. Like here, they're talking about the Christianity in Europe and any kind of the same thing in Asia. That's why, actually, from the late 19th century to early 20th century, there are now even so many scholars and intellectuals and politicians. They are fascinated by the idea of Confucianism. Even the Confucianism almost died in China itself. So that's why they try to create the kind of the organic the sense of the Asia based on some cultural identity. That's for example, that's why there was a close relations between the idea of East Asia and the Confucianism. So that's why they try. Actually, that idea came from their observations on the Europe at that time. So this is the one thing. Of course, you have some common cultural experience in a certain region. However, as I argued in other places, that even in China, not only to talking about the other countries, even in China, it's very difficult to define China as a Confucian country. Because, you know, it's the Qing Dynasty is a Manchu Empire. Yuan Dynasty is a Mongolian Empire. At that time, there some it's a Buddhism, some it's a the Islam. So it's very difficult to simply argue that it's Confucianism could be a kind of thing, but it's play a great part. So it's not such a, just like in this sense, it's also like in Europe, it's very complicated and not simply say it's a Europe, it's a Christian Europe. It's not that simple. That's why, but however, for me, it's not the real question. The real question is that diversity of Asia or the whole world is the reality we have to face. That's the important question is that how to create a kind of flexible framework to have to live together. I mean, that's the more the attractive issue there. It's, that's why a lot of discussions in last years in East Asia and other areas, they are really try to understand the interactions and the conflicts because of those so-called the religious conflicts or the cultural conflicts and what could happen and any other possibilities there. So this is their discussion. The second one, I couldn't answer. Maybe it's really difficult to think about that in that way. I myself.
Three ominous questions, really. One is that you opposed Lenin and Fukuzawa. But wouldn't it have been more maybe relevant to take Okakura as somebody who directly responded to Fukuzawa's view of Japan's modernization as a process of leaving Asia and as a revolutionary Asianist response to that internalization of Orientalism? You didn't mention him at all, but...
Yeah, partly because when I wrote this essay, some other scholars have wrote a very brilliant essay on that issue. So they're talking about the whole generation influenced by him, especially after the Chinese Revolution. They try to perceive the China as the real resources to overcome the Western modernity. Mm. So that's a so-called the issue of overcoming modernity. So, however, that school or that trend, intellectual trend, almost died after the Cultural Revolution, the Chinese Cultural Revolution, because of the disillusion, kind of the disillusion of the Chinese Revolution, because of in Japan.
It's very much alive.
However, now there was some new tendency to revive that one. And also, I'm not simply opposing even the Lenin and the Fukuzawa. Of course, I'm more critical to the Fukuzawa Yukichi's idea of departure from Asia, because, however, historically, you know that it's a national trend in the 19th century there. It's very nationalistic and imperialistic. There were some implications there.
Well, on the other hand, both ways, doesn't it? I mean, Japanese Asianism has both. Even at the height of the greater co-prosperity sphere, there are people like Miki Kiyoshi and even Nishida, who are very, on the one hand, you know, they're ambiguous about imperialism.
Yeah, there were a lot of. And even the Lenin itself, I do believe that there was something we can learn from him. Because it is, of course, I have the criticism on his logic there, because it's still from the basic idea is from Hegelian historical world history and so on and so forth. However, he really make us to understand that when we confront the dilemmas of the modern world, it's not simply could you have some reason to confront the whole logic of the world order. Mm-hmm. So you have to find some inner logic or the counter logic from within. Mm. So that's why he's talking about the capitalism. Of course, his idea of the socialism come from there. Even the socialism as a movement, social movements, it failed. However, the thinking of that, it's not possible to avoid the thinking of that. That the question he raised at that time.
Okay.
The
other thing is regarding your reading of Hamashita Takeshi, because you seem to be saying that he's reconstructing a view of a world system centered on China, which I agree with. But what's interesting is how much he focuses on maritime networks and on elevating the peripheries. So it's also an anti-Sinocentric move at the same time, giving more historical agency to Southeast Asia and Japan.
Yes.
And the last third thing I wanted to speak about was your periodization. You said after 97 there's been more discussion of Asia in Asia. But at least in Japan and Southeast Asia, it's been since the mid-80s, hasn't it? I mean, I agree, it's exploded after 97, but
your two questions, a very quick response. The one, you are right, that I argued that the Hamashita Takeshi's arguments on the tributary system, only focus on the maritime connections, actually reduced continental interactions. It's very much. On the one hand, it's a criticism of the China-centered or continental centralism. This is his strength here. But on the other hand, these kind of the strengths parallel to the narrative of the capitalism. That's a C theory. It's based on that one. So that the whole development of the modern capitalism, it's really based on the maritime connections. So in that sense, the reduction of by reducing the importance of the continental interactions to the so minimum levels, it's really a problematic from my point of view. So there, how to see the interactions between the continental interactions and the maritime interactions, it's very important. The second way is that actually there was a lot of the discussions, of course, for the whole long history. The discussions on Asia in Japan never disappeared, in a sense. But it's remained a domestic discussion at that time. However, under the 1997, it's really a kind of the international discussion there.
We have several people now waiting to ask questions, so I think I'll just take a cluster of three. Yeah, you were waiting for it.
My question is about the relationship between China and Japan. Recently, it seems that there's a lot of political conflict between the two countries. And it seems that the Chinese central government manipulate this kind of nationalism as a kind of ideology to mobilize the people. So what do you think of this kind of nationalism in China and in Japan? Do you think this kind of conflict exists for a long time? Is it possible to have this kind of unity of Asia? Thank you.
Thank you very much. It is always argued that if a region is going to become a defined region, it needs, to use a postmodern term, another. Europe required Islam, it is argued. The West needed communism. And some would say after 9/11 that Europe now needs a new other, which is the Bush administration of the United States, which is now helping to define a new Europe in relationship to the other. What is Asia's other?
Okay.
Will it be the United States?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's.
Over here, one more.
Thank you. I just want to ask, what is the significance of studying Asia as a whole in modern days? Because is it really more than a geographical, you know, item when we look at Asia? Inside Asia, there are so many complex problems like Japan and China. We pretend to be friends, like Malaysia and Singapore.
We hope we stay friends.
like China and Vietnam, right? And each country after Second World War, we treasure more than any other states in any other continents our independence. Yeah. How can we under such a complex historical background study Asia as a whole and what's the significance of it? And the next question is, it's still an old problem. When embracing the modern democratic ideas, do we really need to sacrifice our traditional values? In China, obviously our country, you realize that many, you know, traditional values is decaying, and in Taiwan it's just a failure you know, example of modern democracy poisoned by their own certain problems. So for example, Singapore is doing quite fine. So how do you see this problem as a scholar from Asia? Thank you very much.
Can I add just one gloss on that? I put that point a different way. When I was in Shanghai recently and landed at the airport, I was struck by the advertisements at the airport and then over the city. I mean, the first image I saw over and over again is of David Beckham selling and promoting Vodafone. The second for the Harry Potter novels, which are hugely successful in China. And the third, believe it or not, now, given their contemporary irrelevance, are the Spice Girls, where the CDs are still doing very well in China. And I wonder to what extent, not a quick question about democracy, but about Western consumption cultures. Yeah. To what extent is the spread of Western forms of consumption and desire for new forms of commodities and so on going to disrupt any concept of a homogenous Asia? To what extent, in other words, is Western consumption styles going to be perhaps the most profound challenge to what it is that people think of themselves when they think of themselves as perhaps young Chinese or young Asians?
Okay. Four questions. First of all, it's really difficult for me to answer the conflicts between China and Japan and the issue of nationalism. It is this question, of course. Now you say you argued that the Chinese government manipulated the nationalist or to do something, and actually both sides the same one. Not only simply to the relations between China and Japan. When I was in Japan the year before last year, at that time the broad coverage in the newspapers on the kidnapping accident, because some Japanese was kidnapped by the North Korean, And then a lot of the reports there. And you do not, suddenly the whole history disappeared and everybody became played the game of the victim. So everybody became the victim in order to mobilize the whole society to doing that. So this is the situation here. And very complicated, very difficult to deal with. I guess it will continue for quite a long time. And also these kind of the question, it's related to the second question about what's the other of Asia, because it's relevant to see the complexity of this issue. And because the whole issue, because the Japanese national, we know that the historical issues now argued between Japan and other countries, the China, Korea, and the South Asian countries, because after half centuries later, now the Japanese government never formally apologized for the war crime. And these, of course, in many Japanese intellectuals has pointed out that the Japanese the contemporary Japanese nationalism to some extent is the product of the post-war order arrangements, mainly by America. So that's the preservation of the royal system. And the whole, even the war crime tribunal at that time was really unequal. And also they released a lot of the criminals there. And no real the judgments after the war. All these kind of the things now piled year after year. So it became very difficult, the issues. So many the Asian intellectuals, especially Japanese intellectuals and Korean intellectuals, they very, very strongly argued that the discussion of the Asia always contain the significance or the meaning or implication of de-Americanization. So without the de-Americanization, it's almost not possible to have such a kind of the imagination, imaginaries of Asia itself. So this is the question, the same here. It's a share with the Europe here. It's always talking about it. However, it's so difficult because the situation in Asia and the situation in Europe, it's really different, not because of its cultural history, but also the post-war arrangements in the worldwide. So we're talking about the end of the Cold War. However, it's really difficult to argue the Cold War has ended in Asia, because you still have the Taiwan Strait conflict there. You still have the North Korea issue and the North and the South and all these things there. And the military, huge military armament was there. So that's in danger. Then why such discussion? In that sense, the meaning of the significance of this discussion on Asia is really try to encourage intra-Asia interactions in order to have a common sense for our history. So that's, in that sense, it's not raised the issue. It's not relevant to talking about the study of Asia as a whole. It's not that really study Asia as a totality, but also propertizing the Asia. It's really interesting because it's a try to encourage the people to see the interactions, not only because last 20 years we always that our thinking or our discussion always are shaped by the dichotomy of China and the West, Japan and the West, and every single country in East Asia or Asia and the West, always that. Now we really try to revive the thinking about our relation, intra-Asia culture. That's why they developed the intra-Asia culture studies to do that. At the same time, some Korean scholars, when dealing with the issue of the history, that's the war, and Korean intellectuals, Ha Yong-so, he actually suggested, I think it's interesting, but it's also very difficult, to have a kind of the project of common textbook, which means that we invited the Chinese scholars, Korean scholars, Japanese scholars, South Asian scholars to live that get together to discuss about our history and to produce some kind of the textbook for the education system. We know that all these things maybe takes us so long, maybe several generations maybe. So every country have its own national history, and that national history always have its different versions of textbook for the generations, the younger generations. So is it possible for such kind of the project? I don't know at this moment, but I really see the significance of that. So in that sense, when the people launched the kind of the discussion on the issue of Asia, what they really wanted to do is to resolve such questions, its difficulties. And your question is, of course, now if you visit Shanghai, Beijing, not only these central cities, even those cities in inland China, obviously it's really westernized. It's really difficult to see that. Consumerism is really dominant ideology. Developmentalism is dominant policy and a dominant ideology in China right now. But on the other hand, you see that in every level, especially at the local level, the people, you always, of course, that's still weak. But on the other hand, then when they faced the crisis, you suddenly realize that some sources for their attitudes or the imagination, it's really reappeared. For example, last year, during the SARS crisis, that period, so many people, especially in the surrounding area of Beijing, those peasants, and many peasants really want to have some their self, the communal relations in order to defend themselves, protect themselves. And also, you know, after the so many years after the Chinese reform, the medical system in rural area almost collapsed. So how to do that? And the peasants have to create the network to protect themselves. And that kind of the connections, they always could be traced back to their own memory of their the history. So it's not simply the idea of Confucianism or any other things, but the customs or the cultures in their daily life could provide something to again these dominant the tendency.
Thank you very much. We have time for just perhaps one or two more final reflections and questions, please. We'll just take two more questions.
Right, thank you very much, Professor Wang Hui. Yeah. I'm very much impressed about your profound knowledge and research on the commentary and some of the particular issues about China. And I would like to take this opportunity to raise up two issues to consult from you. One of them is you've just mentioned about the crisis of religion and Confucianism as a kind of a heritage belief that made up the center of the value in China. As you all know that China has traditionally had Buddhism, Taoism, and Confucianism to be at the center of the belief that regulates the behavior of the societies and the people all along the past thousands of years. But towards the recent time of China, after the dominating of the Communist Party, they have cracked down all of the opposing spiritual movement and religions and beliefs, including the above, the previously mentioned three religions, and has set up their communist belief systems. But after the fail of the Cultural Revolution and the collapse of these belief systems, China has nowadays come into a stage of vacuum of spiritual belief and religion. And how would you reckon on this issue, please? And what are we going to do about that?
Final question.
Hi, I'm Kapil and I'm from India. My question is pretty simple. What I want to ask you is that discussions and academic disclosures like these, are these intended to shape up the way we look at Asia, or are they just supposed to strengthen the image of Asia which we are trying to build? Because throughout your disclosure of whatever length, 95% of the times Asia seemed to be just China, Japan, and Korea, while the traditional figure of Asia has been including India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and all these countries. So I'm concerned with the fact that India was conspicuously missing out of the whole discussion. And basically, if you look at it at either from an economic or from a historical or social perspective, religious perspective, from all the perspectives, Asia is composed of many more countries than just these three. The only common thing between these three countries are the level of economic development and possibly the way people look there. So I wanted to ask you as to whether the academic discussions and debates, should they be aimed towards building an image of Asia or to strengthen what is already going on? Thank you.
Let me ask you one final question. I mean, Europe has always set itself up to be an ideal for the rest of the world, and it's been a highly problematic one, of course, and in the 20th century, we brought the world to the edge of the abyss not just once, but twice. Do you really, since 1945, however, Europe has reconstituted itself in a way which now does seem to have come of age, a model of international cooperation, multilateral commitment, pooling of sovereignty of key areas, and with the exception of this country, has taken a very different tack in the last 2 to 3 years, providing a model of peacemaking and peacekeeping, which is weak in some respects, the absence of any capacity for long-distance coercive power, but nonetheless an alternative model to that proffered and championed now by the United States. Do you think, finally, slightly ironic question, do you think Europe has come of age, and finally this is a European model that ought to be respected in other parts of the world, and perhaps even emulated?
The first question is about the revivals of this religion in China. Of course, it's a very important phenomenon. And more than 10 years ago, when I was in Shaanxi province in a county, I worked there. And in the 1 year, we found that that county established more than 700 temples. And different kind of the temples, not only the Buddhism, Taoism, but also different popular religions. You don't know what it is. So of course, at that time, the local governments really tried to persuade the peasants to destruct those temples because of the paucity of land and some others. But obviously, there was some kind of the crisis of the meaning, maybe for this, the peasants feel that after the People's Commune dissolved, they feel that they need something. It is parallel to the revival of the communal relations at that time. However, now the situation it's also changed because the migration it's become it's very important phenomena. So in that sense, it's not this kind of the revival of the religion is not necessarily associated with the local community. Not only because a lot of the people they just try to choose something for their believing, and how to deal with that kind of the question is really difficult. I have no the whole set of the arrangement for that because. First of all, you have to tolerate many beliefs there. And also, it has created some very practical questions according to my experience in that country. For example, in my country at that time, the land, it's very, you know, it's very few, it's very little. And then the temples established there for so many. However, even in the mountains, some area at that time, simply no electricity. The local governments encouraged the peasants to have the line to connect it to their village, but they rejected. And then they established a temple and connected a line to there to serve the God, in their God. It's living God. It's a living God there. So a lot of the actual questions that to deal with, that this is a very, very important phenomenon, and it's a big issue on that. But it seems that nobody related these kind of the question with the more political issues. Besides, only the one exception is a Falun Gong. These kind of the question, it's really totally another to another level. And
we no, can't hear you. You're up here. You have to
talking about. You mean asking me to talk about the Falun Gong now? It's could I after that question, and then if I have time, I. Yeah.
Okay, the question is clear.
Yeah.
Right, the question is clear. We need to start. Yeah. I need to stop at 8.
Now
the question is clear.
If I have time, I come back because it's I'm sorry that I have no the ability or capacity to discuss about that, but I realize that. I know that there was a huge paucity of the knowledge or the sources in our current discussion there. And why I focus on the East Asia, because this is what I participated in the discussion. It's always focused on there. Not only, it's not intentionally to exclude any parts of Asia out of the discussion. Actually, last year, we have the first time we held a conference in Bangalore, organized the conference to try to have the discussion not only from the East Asian countries, but also from India, Nepal, Sri Lanka, and Pakistan. For me, I know many Indian friends, but I never come across any scholars from Nepal and Pakistan even. So, but at that moment, there were a lot of discussion. And then these occasions remind us how little we know about so-called Asia. That's our, we try to identify ourselves as Asian, because that's what I say. We used to ask the questions from the dichotomy of the West and ourselves. So then we suddenly realize, even like the communication between India and China is so rich in our history. Not only the Buddhism, even the modern nationalism. In modern nationalism, one of the very important figure before the 1911 revolution, the Chiang Kai-shek, one of the leading intellectuals at that time, when exiled in Japan. The first time for Chinese intellectuals raised the issue of Asia, it's according to my reading, it's Chiang Kai-shek in 1903. At that time, he met some Indian scholars and exiles in Tokyo, and they studied the language, Indian languages, and then they tried to organize a society, that's a so-called Asian society for the friendship and intimacy, and to talking about that one, in order to overcome the potential crisis that's emerged within the East Asia, they're always against the tendency or imperialist tendency in Japan at that time. So after that, a lot of the whole modern period, even in the 60s or 70s, we still have a lot of the translation from India. However, after the end of the 70s, suddenly the most of the translation, for example, it's always mainly it's from the West, and very few books available about the other societies within Asia. So that's the situation. Everybody, like my generation, everybody situated in that context. So that's the one thing. The second I try to add to your question is not only, actually it's not only the South Asia and the Middle East, almost excluded not intentionally included in the discussion, but there were some discussion, not so many. But also, even in the Northeast Asia, the North Korea and Mongolia, almost no scholars there now participated in such discussion. We don't know what's their views and how they perceive these kind of the discussion. So this is really the dilemmas we are facing, that we try to overcome this one. So that's why the some intellectuals here in Asia try to establish the intellectual project of intra-Asia cultural studies, that they have them, all them to go. Then your that question.
Your final reflection.
Yeah, okay. This is a very interesting phenomenon because last decades, you know, intellectually, most of the very important tendency, it's from, like, in Chinese intellectual landscape, they're talking about the Eurocentrism and so on and so forth. But this kind of the critique of Eurocentrism is not, I do believe that it's not exclusion of the experience here we can learn from. It's always learn from here. And so this time, it's very interesting. It's up to, then we always know that it's not because of the idea, even the simple ideology, but also the whole trend, the reality we have to face, force us to think about the possibilities and the potentials. For example, the debates in Europe and the different ideas, different the opinions about the EU, it's really fascinating for the many Asian intellectuals when they talk thought about our own problems. That's another. For example, we know that not only the Japan, China have such problem. Not only that, the mainland China and the Taiwan is also the problem here. So, are there any possibilities, the more flexible arrangements, and new ideas? Not only the like a sovereignty, but some new ideas can be helpful to resolve the conflicts there. It's not really simply introduced or learned just imported from the Europe, but really this kind of the practice, the historical practice itself, it's inspiring for us.
Well, it remains for me just to say, to mention two things. One is that the next Miliband lecture in this series will be Akbar Ahmed here on the 15th of June, who will talk the theme of Islam under siege. And the second thing I need to do is, of course, thank our speaker very much. I thought it was a positive treasure chest of ideas and much to take away. So thank you so much.
Thank you.